Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I guess we're due at this time.
We are?
To do another sweets program.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and if you're crazy for ice cream, as I am, and particularly if you
ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream, that's Ann.
Yes. So, but this is the best book. I say this repeatedly in the discussion with Dana Cree, the author. It's the best book on ice cream I've ever seen.
So you're going to want to listen to this interview, and then you're going to want to rush out and buy an ice cream maker and make some of the wonderful recipes that she talks about.
It's a cute name. My name is Ice Cream. Well, I'm going to start not as I usually do with the question. We're interviewing Dana Cree, but I just wanted to repeat what I told her. Hands down, her book, Hello, My Name is Ice Cream, The Art and Science of the Scoop, is the best book on ice cream I've ever read. Absolutely perfect, Dana.
Well, thank you so much.
And
we hope you're blushing.
Oh, I mean, it's clearly, I do not make ice cream, and I do not buy an ice cream machine simply because I would eat it, and I would gain 25 pounds.
Oh, well, that's what the frozen yogurt's for.
It's what?
It's what the frozen yogurt's for.
Oh, yes.
That's lighter in calories?
Yeah. A touch.
Just a touch.
So was gelato, but I could go crazy on that, too. You know, I, reading this, learned so much, and I did read it. I mean, I don't always read all the books, but I did use this. Starting with your introduction, and it shows you've been really involved with ice cream practically from birth, huh?
I think we've all been introduced to ice cream long before we can even remember. It's one of those flavors that's always been with us.
You write the next chapter is how to use this book, and you divide it up to the knowledge, the recipes, and my favorite section, these composed scoops. Start with the knowledge. You tell me in this, you tell readers in this book, the five components of ice cream. And I'll tell you, to this day, I didn't understand the rationale of things like churning and whatnot. The stabilizers. Your comments on stabilizers I found really very revealing. What do you say about them?
Stabilizers have gotten a sort of nasty name. And that people have come to think of them as an artificial additive that is added to cheat and make food have like a really long shelf life and sort of be poison to your body. But really a stabilizer is any ingredient that stabilizes the size of the ice crystal in your ice cream. Because water has a very strong desire to pull together. I don't know, in elementary school we had science lessons on the polarity of water, and we watched little water droplets pull together and bigger water droplets, and that's going to happen inside your ice cream.
From what you say in your book, your fifth grade science teacher was a lot better than mine.
Mrs. Pritchard.
Oh, yeah, Pritchard.
She was incredible. She's incredible.
So you learned about polarity.
Yeah. So water really, really wants to pull together. And in the freezer, the water in your ice cream is going to fluctuate in temperature because our freezers are so inefficient at home. I mean, just think about every single time somebody goes in there for an ice cube or a frozen burrito or a scoop of ice cream, or just to stand there and look and see if they're hungry for anything in there. Every time that happens, the temperature inside fluctuates. The ice, some of the ice melts, and then as it gets colder, it refreezes. But if it melts and there's nothing to stabilize the water, it will gather together, and then when it refreezes, it forms larger ice crystals. So I think almost everybody is familiar with icy ice cream.
Yes.
And particularly if they've made it at home, one of the biggest questions I get from ice cream makers at home is why is my homemade ice cream so icy?
Yes.
And the reality is we are at a mechanical disadvantage in churning because we don't have the kinds of powerful machines that the pros have. And then we're at a mechanical disadvantage with our freezers as well because they don't hold the ice cream in place. So a stabilizer is any ingredient that keeps the water from pulling together, and that can be a commercial gum with a name that you can't pronounce and like really scary sounding things, or it can be something as simple as cornstarch or pectin, or gelatin was the original stabilizer in ice cream. So I really hoped to just shed light on what a stabilizer did, what things you can use to stabilize your ice cream, the benefit that you'll get from it, and then really leave it up to the reader to decide whether they want to bring a stabilizer into their ice cream at home and give them the choice of which one they want to use, what their comfort level is. Really leave it up to them. I mean, the whole book is written to empower home ice cream makers to make the kind of ice cream they want to make.
So, I mean, basically, home ice cream makers are at something of a disadvantage, but in your book, you give us tips on how to overcome the disadvantages, right?
Yes, yeah. So ice cream recipes themselves, they're most of the same flavors that I make for the restaurants that I work at. In fact, when I gave one of the advanced copies to my cooks, we were flipping through it, and I had to apologize. I was like, I'm sorry, there's no new material in here for you. I've already given you all these recipes. But the ratios are very different. For the home cook, I add a lot more butterfat to the ice cream because it improves the texture at home. The sugar levels are different because the freezing mechanics are different of the machines, and the freezers are different as well.
And you have a whole section on the machines as well, because that, I mean, there's such an array of possibilities with ice cream makers. You kind of short-circuit that and give your recommendations on what to look for.
I do, and I spent a good chunk of the advance purchasing every ice cream maker that was available to the home cook to test with. And we did all the testing in my house, and I insisted on everything being done with the kind of equipment people would have in their houses. It didn't make any sense if I had success with the recipes in a professional setting because they were going to be made at home. So my recipe tester and I went to IKEA and Target and bought the kinds of kitchen equipment that people would have at home because, unfortunately, I have stocked my home kitchen with all of the professional equipment. And we went out and we bought every single ice cream maker that we could get, mostly from Amazon, and tested the recipes in each of those. Because one of the second questions I get besides why is my ice cream so icy is, what ice cream maker do you recommend?
Uh-huh.
So I can just flip to the section in the book and show everybody how the ice cream makers work. The physics of the ice cream makers are exactly the same, whether it's the kind that you churn with ice and salt by hand or the little machines where you freeze the bowl overnight, or a machine with a compressor as well. The only difference is how the cold transfers to the ice cream.
And we're not going to tell anybody which one you recommend, right? We're going to make them buy the book so they can find out.
Oh, well, they probably want to order the book and the ice cream machine at the same time.
There you go.
So,
right.
I think the best bang for your buck is the Cuisinart countertop ice cream maker where you freeze the bowl. I've actually run restaurants on those machines before. I had like a little army of them lined up on the counter churning a quart at a time.
Oh, wow.
And if you buy the book, if you buy the book and the Cuisinart ice cream maker, you're spending enough, you get free shipping?
Yes.
Yeah.
Probably.
And Dana, you've sort of skirted this. You are a pastry chef.
In your
real life, you were a pastry chef and an award-winning one as well from the James Beard Awards, twice a finalist. And you've worked at a number of really interesting restaurants.
I have.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about that. You're right now at the Publican, right, in Chicago. Which, by the way, I think we're going to come visit you when we're in.
Are we going to do that?
I think so. We'll come see her.
Oh,
get to meet you.
Wonderful. There's lots of ice cream on the menu.
Good. I was thinking of your past experience when I was reading your section called The Color of Flavor, because you stodged at the Fat Duck in Bray, England. And I,
yes.
Of course, we've eaten there too. And I remember the first time I got this, you call it a parlor trick. And it really is explained about the orange and the red.
Yep. So one of the things that I learned at the Fat Duck, which opened my eyes to sort of, the Fat Duck was the experience that was like Neo seeing the Matrix for the first time.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden all he saw was like numbers dripping down. It was the first peek behind the curtain to realize that there was science underlying everything that we were doing in the kitchen, and that if you could sort of peek behind that curtain and learn about the science, you could build your cuisine in more interesting, stronger, and more educated ways. But one of the things I learned there was how powerful color is on our perception of flavor, because we see our food before we eat it, so what it looks like and the color of it determines what we assume the flavor is going to be. And that is actually so strong that our perception of color can actually alter what we think flavor is. And the common trick is to blindfold somebody and give them red and white wine.
Oh, that's funny, too. They can't tell.
Yeah. They can't tell, or Coca-Cola and 7-Up.
Uh-huh.
Without color, like, we can't perceive flavor.
It's funny. And Heston Blumenthal did what at the Fat Duck?
So Heston sent out a tiny course, and it was a disc of jelly or jello, and half of it was deep red, and the other half was bright orange, and he told you that it was beets and orange. And so you'd eat it, and then you could see people's, like, brains, I don't know, breaking. and you finally realized that the orange side was golden beet and the red side was blood orange. But when you look at it and you think beet and orange, you automatically assume the opposite. So that really, really just helped me understand that color is as important to flavor as flavor, if not more.
Right. So there's a section. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so there's a section in the book called The Color of Flavor, or The Flavor of Color. I can't remember which, but
The Color of Flavor.
The Color of Flavor. It was actually the last section I added to the book, because after doing all of the testing and making these ice creams over and over and over again, and mind you, I didn't test anything. I made sure I was hands-off, and I let somebody else do all of the testing because it would be too easy for me to override things and forget that not everybody, that my instructions don't mean the same thing to everybody. But I was just staring at white scoop after white scoop after white scoop after white scoop, and I realized, like, I needed to do something about this. So we went and looked at what we could add to ice cream that wasn't a food dye that would alter the color. So we found, we actually found quite a few things, but narrowed it down to just one ingredient per color of the rainbow, and included brown and even black. And, yeah, my favorite find was blue, which I wasn't sure I was going to
do. Yeah, I was surprised by that one.
Yeah, we found a spirulina, which is a blue-green algae.
Yep.
And there is one from a very specific company, and it's called Blue Magic. And it turns your food robin's egg blue, and it's beautiful.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I have a question. Let me slide this question in before I forget about it, because I know you're just exactly the right person to ask it. Why is it that everybody loves vanilla ice cream? I remember as a child, I always wondered, because I didn't like vanilla ice cream. I liked chocolate ice cream.
but everybody
else seemed
you're
to
English.
Like...
You're English. The English love chocolate.
why is it the subtlety of the flavor, or what is it exactly?
Well, that's actually one of my missions in life, is to convince everybody that vanilla is the furthest thing from a plain flavor in the world.
Oh, yes.
in America, vanilla has become the non-flavor. If it doesn't have a flavor, it's vanilla.
Exactly.
And I blame artificial vanilla, which is just the singular flavor molecule called vanillin that's extracted from wood pulp during the paper milling process.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it really sounds objectionable, right?
It is objectionable. So
artificial vanilla is very, very inexpensive, so inexpensive that it's put in literally everything. And if you are boring, you've come to be known as vanilla, yeah. Which I think is such an injustice to the flavor, because when you look at what it is, it's actually the seed pod of an orchid,
right,
that only grows within 1 degree of the equator. Yeah. And to harvest vanilla, they take these green pods that look like green beans, and they mature them in the sun for 9 months. For 9 months, they sit on racks. They're carried out into the sun during the day. They're stacked up at night and wrapped so that all the heat from the sun sweats them, and they ferment, and they're hand massaged. And 9 months after this starts, then they're finally ready to be distributed. So you take this incredibly exotic plant, and you treat it for 9 months with care by hand, and then distribute it to America, and we think it's plain. Well, like, I feel like that's one of the most spoiled things we could possibly say, that this, like, incredibly exotic, rare thing is plain. But I think the reason we like it so much is it actually has almost 1,000 aroma molecules in it. So aside from vanillin, that one flavor molecule that we recognize as vanilla, it has almost 1,000 other things going on. And the only other foods that have that much complexity to them are coffee and chocolate. Uh-huh. So it's like we like it because it's incredibly complex.
Right.
We just don't know it because we think it's plain.
Well, most people are they're used to vanilla extract as opposed to vanilla beans or, you know.
Yeah. And vanilla extract is made by mashing the entire bean, seeds, and pulp. So for anybody listening that doesn't know what a vanilla bean is, because they've only used extract, which is definitely something I had experienced up until I was in culinary school, it's a very long black bean, and you have to cut it open and scrape out about 1 million tiny seeds that are no bigger than the pinpoint of a needle. And these seeds contain a wallop of flavor. One single vanilla bean will flavor a quart of ice cream with so much intensity, you'll be shocked. And then the outside is a pod, which has a lot of the vanilla flavor, but it also contains dried fruit flavors because it is the dried vegetable matter of the seed pod. So vanilla manufacturers, in order to make vanilla extract, they mash the entire bean with the seed, soak it in alcohol, the flavor transfers into the alcohol, and then they strain it.
Yeah. As far away from real vanilla extract, flavor as possible.
Yeah. The vanilla extract has a lot of the pod flavor in it as well.
Yeah.
But if you just use the seeds, you'll find really like one of the most beautiful flavors you have ever encountered in your life. And at retail prices, a vanilla bean can be $8 to $10, which seems like an outlandish ingredient to put into your ice cream. But trust me, it is one of the few things that's worth it.
There was some sort of a natural disaster, some sort of storm that wiped out the crop of one of these vanilla producing regions. I can't remember which one.
Probably Madagascar, I would think.
No, what's it?
Wasn't Madagascar?
No, it was smaller than that. Yes, I think so. No, it wasn't the.
Where was it?
It was in the news, but I was just mentioning it because not only is it all hand picked and cured and whatever, it also is subject to the forces of nature, and you can easily, you just have a real brief opportunity to harvest it, and you can have your whole harvest wiped out. And I mean, you know the Vanilla Queen?
Patricia Rain, her name is.
Patricia Rain. Well, she spends a lot of her time now trying to help the vanilla growers in all these far-flung places. So we know about vanilla. Tell us about, you have a section here on different kinds of ice creams, and I think there's a lot of confusion about what is what. And you do custard ice creams, and you say what actually that is. I never heard of, and you have recipes, by the way, which we'll get back to in a minute. Except, boy, I mean, some of this toasted hay ice cream, you have some really wonderful recipes. Green cardamom, which I adore. Then you have Philadelphia ice cream, which I never heard of, and I lived in Philadelphia. Then you explain the difference with gelato, which is certainly a whole other thing. And what are the other ones you hit on here? I'm just looking through the book.
I broke all of the recipes for ice cream. I broke up into four chapters. The custard base is ice cream that's made with eggs. Philadelphia is ice cream that's made without eggs. And it's literally something that anybody even hears of. I hadn't even heard of it until after I had graduated culinary school.
Really?
We don't know of it as Philadelphia ice cream because it's so predominant in America. Like, most of the ice cream you eat in ice cream parlors and Baskin-Robbins and the little sort of like seasonal shops that are old-fashioned, the ice cream base doesn't have eggs in it. So it's so predominant in America, we just know it as ice cream. And then there are sherbets, which I consider a lost art of ice cream, which
are
very low.
Yeah, you don't see that very often.
Yeah, and I don't know why, because they're the best way to make a fruit-flavored ice cream, because they're very low in butterfat and very, very high in fruit. So each recipe contains 25% fruit, and they'll be the most fruit-forward ice creams you ever make. And then there's a chapter on frozen yogurts, which I put in there not as a low-fat version, but as a celebration of the flavor of yogurt in ice cream.
I see.
And then each chapter opens with a blank slate recipe, which is meant to be altered. So it doesn't have any flavor in it. So if you want to start inventing your own flavors, you have a template to work with, because one of the things that happens with ice cream is if you take a recipe from somebody and you start altering flavor, the texture tends to fall apart. So I gave you a blank template, and then all of the recipes in the chapter that follow. So for the custard ice cream, there's a green cardamom ice cream and a cold-pressed coffee ice cream and an eggnog ice cream. All of those I based off of the template as well.
Right.
So you can sort of see how I changed, like I introduced flavor if you look back at the blank template.
Some of these are simply amazing. How about popcorn ice cream? You like bubblegum ice cream?
Yes. So bubblegum is one of my favorites because no bubblegum was actually harmed in the making of this ice cream. After a conversation with a man named Chris Young, who
I met
at the Fat Duck,
yes,
and who was in Seattle. We're both from Seattle. So he was back in Seattle writing Modernist Cuisine. I asked him how to make bubblegum, and he came back to me and said, well, he didn't have that information, but he found out what the main flavorings in bubblegum were. And they're orange, lemon, banana, and vanilla.
Yeah, I thought that was amazing. Yeah.
So if you add those four things to ice cream, it'll taste like bubblegum. And then I add a little bit of strawberry, which solved the problem of pink for me and brought it back from tasting too much like artificial candy and back into the world of like natural flavor. But we use a little bit of orange zest, lemon zest, vanilla, and then you have to buy banana extract for this, which I thought was going to be hard to find, but it turns out McCormick sells banana extract, and
really?
It's in almost every grocery store. Hmm. It's just, I think sometimes when you're not looking for something, it disappears into the background, but it was sitting there right next to the vanilla extracts.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, we don't even have enough time to cover all this. I want to point out that if people think they know their flavors of ice cream, this is an eye-opener, all the things you put together, and also how the actual technique of dealing with add-ins, which is something I never even considered. I just thought of them as something you threw in. But you have a special technique of dealing with all of that. And then my favorite was reading through your composed, what do you call them, composed cones?
Yep, composed scoops.
Composed scoops are just amazing.
Yep. Yeah, so I grew up in the era of Ben and Jerry, so I love a lot of chunks and ripples and ribbons and, like, combination flavors in my ice cream. So there are 20 recipes in which I combine recipes from the book into these composed scoops. And then I show you my layering techniques and then my technique for swirling two ice cream flavors together so they don't bleed into each other. And the idea is that after following my recipes, you now have the information you need to start inventing your own flavors. And there's a website on the back of the book, if you flip it over, on the back cover, it's helloicecreamchicago.com, and then that, it actually sends you to hellomyNameIsIceCream.com, and on that website is a page called What's Your Flavor, and it is a blog that I built to be a living archive so that readers could submit the flavors they're inventing with the book.
Oh, great. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh,
because
Dana,
I really,
this is a masterpiece.
I really want to see.
I mean, I really
I
want to
see what people make.
Oh, that would be fun, huh? Who knows?
Yeah, anybody can submit it. You get to upload a picture, and then you can talk about what the flavor is, and I don't know whether you liked it or disliked it, and hopefully it'll sort of act as a community center for people to talk about what they're making and see what other people are making. And
well, you know, if you can judge by some of the books that we're getting, you're probably going to get a lot of cannabis recipes for ice cream. That and insects. Oh. Insects is the other one, weren't they?
Yes.
They keep telling me that's what I'm going to have to eat, and I'm saying, no, I don't think so. Well, I just think it's wonderful. I'd love to be able to go through and taste all of your flavors because they're ingenious. I can only say congratulations and please save a top-notch donut ice cream sample for me.
Oh, absolutely.
Again, it's Dana Cree, a really respected, well-respected pastry chef from Chicago, or in Chicago now, and the book is Hello, My Name is Ice Cream. Dana, thank you so much for this wonderful book and for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking to me.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're now moving on to another one of my passions, absolutely super fine chocolate. Anyhow, I've been hearing about this artisanal chocolate company, and I, in one place and another place, and it became very pronounced in my head. So I contacted Todd Masonis, who is the founder or co-founder of Dandelion Chocolates. And I got to talk to him about chocolates, and I got to sample, and it is good. How about great? We're talking to Todd Masonis. Meanwhile, we've been absolutely reveling in his chocolate, his artisanal chocolate. The company is called Dandelion Chocolates, Todd. And I asked you why it was called Dandelion Chocolates, and what did you say?
And I said that we wanted a name that was a little bit more grounded. It sounded like a lot of people in the chocolate world were going for super fancy jewelry store chocolate, and we wanted something that was an upstart and a weed with childhood nostalgia and just sort of met the vibe of the company.
Now, I've found, we have interviewed an awful lot of chocolatiers, and I have found them as a group to be absolutely intriguing. I don't know why that is, but, and diverse. I mean, we've talked to one who is, in his previous existence, was a high-profile criminal defense attorney, a prosecutor, actually. We talked to another one that has a chocolate university. He does all these things overseas. What is your background?
So my background is not the standard, I guess, chocolatier background either. I started a tech company back in Silicon Valley back in 2001 with some friends of mine. And we worked on that company for many years, and then we sold it in 2008, and then had a bunch of free time and a little bit of extra money and started to explore our passions. And so my friend and I, we just started making chocolate for fun in a garage just to see if we could actually do it, if we could, you know, if we could get the beans and roast them up and build the machines necessary to make chocolate. And before we knew it, it started taking off, and people seemed to really like our chocolate. So we just kind of fell into this, even though we're really from the more Silicon Valley tech world originally.
And you don't do any tech stuff now?
I mean, you know, I advise companies, or we use a lot of technology with, you know, the like our back end for figuring out how to roast and reprogram our roaster and all the software that runs the company. But I would say it's kind of a tool we use to make good chocolate. It's not our primary focus anymore.
Yes. Well, of course, you know, we know about tech people who make a fortune. There's Myhrvold. You know him?
Well, yeah, I mean, I haven't met him, but yeah, I definitely know the name.
Yeah,
he probably buys your chocolate. He can probably
he can probably afford it.
Right, right.
Now, your product is really simple. I mean, It's not simplistic, but it's really basic. Your product, your chocolate bars, list the ingredients: chocolate and sugar. Right.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, just beans and sugar. Yep.
But it's the sourcing of it. I mean, I've been testing it, and you can really tell the difference from where the beans come from.
Right.
Yeah, and you have tasting notes like with wine. Describe some of these products to us.
Yeah, well, I think what we're trying to do with chocolate is to keep it simple and to go back to the bean. So a lot of people don't realize that we're sort of at this very interesting moment for chocolate right now, kind of like what happened to microbrew and happened to coffee and to some extent wine is happening to chocolate right now. And so the distinction we always make is the chocolate maker versus the chocolatier. So we consider ourselves to be a chocolate maker. We actually don't consider ourselves to be a chocolatier. So our definition would be we buy beans and we make chocolate, and a chocolatier buys chocolate and makes chocolate. So we're sort of part of this new and growing movement of getting really interesting beans, roasting them up, and trying to get good flavors out of them. And our sort of particular style is to add very little to the chocolate and try to get those interesting flavors out of each bean. So a Madagascar bar might taste very fruity. A bar from Venezuela might be very chocolatey. There might be other bars that are nutty or have more of a coffee flavor. And so all that interesting genetic diversity, all of that processing, all of those flavors that in the past might have gotten lost with a larger manufacturer, we're actually trying to bring them out and to celebrate them and to make sure that when you taste the bar of chocolate, it actually does taste different depending on its origin and the bean.
Now, the interesting thing is, I think I'm right here, chocolate actually was discovered and developed for the first time in the Americas.
Right.
And then it moved to Africa, where it was made on a much larger scale in plantations in places
like
the English colony called the Gold Coast. And then dominated the world of chocolate because the quantities they made were so much larger, and I guess the trees they grew were friendlier to producing large quantities of chocolate. Now chocolate epicenter seems to be coming back to the United, to the States. Am I right there or am I wrong?
Well, I would say yes, for the most part. I mean, I would kind of separate it from the beans and then from the makers. So for the beans, you're exactly right that, you know, chocolate originated somewhere in Central or South America, and that's kind of where the good beans are currently. The beans that made their way to Africa generally tended to be a varietal that had very good yield and high disease resistance, but didn't taste super great. But the goal of sort of the commodity cocoa grinders has always been, how do we get the lowest possible cost and how do we make it very consistent? And so it is sort of a miracle that you can open up a Hershey's bar and it's going to taste the same no matter where you go. And they were able to do that at a very, very low cost. And I feel like they sort of optimized that. But so now there's sort of the new makers that are going back to the old methods and starting very small, who are trying to get those good beans and actually care about the flavor. And, you know, we sometimes call this the new American chocolate movement because it seems like it really has taken off in America. But it's funny, so when we started, this was back in about 2010, we started in the garage, there was only maybe a dozen other chocolate makers, actual companies making chocolate from the bean at a small scale in America. And I think right now the count is over 150 or 200. So it's sort of been exploding. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is we call it the new American chocolate movement, but actually in the last couple of years, we've seen it popping up everywhere around the world. So it's kind of in this new American style and this entrepreneurial culture is actually spreading around the world. And so it's no longer sort of the European style. It's more this new American style, which is much more about the bean.
Now, you pay tribute on your website to Scharfenberger.
That's right.
Fine old American name and a fine old American chocolatier. But he's a chocolate maker. Now, what about Ricuti?
Ricuti's
in San Francisco, not too far from where you are.
Yep.
Probably a 10-minute drive away.
So, Ricuti is a friend of ours. I like him.
He's
a great guy. And so what he does is pretty different than what we do, though, because, again, we would consider ourselves to be a chocolate maker. So we're very concerned with getting really good beans and turning them into really good chocolate. And he is concerned with, you know, getting good chocolate and turning them into really interesting flavors and confections and chocolate.
Right.
And so sort of his work is very complementary to our work, but they're sort of almost two different worlds entirely.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, who are some of the – I could riff off the chocolatiers, but who are some of the other chocolate makers?
Yeah, so the sort of new American chocolate movement has a lot of diverse and interesting players. So I'd say on the West Coast, you have us, but you also have Dick Taylor a little bit north of us. You have Cho.
He's South American, though.
Who, Cho?
Yeah.
Well, they're actually in Oakland, although they do their roasting in Origin. But they're
from South America, and I would think that he would be a chocolatier.
The one I'm talking about is Cho, T-C-H-O.
T-C-H-O. I have it confused. Okay, I do know T-C-H-O because we've interviewed them a number of times.
Yeah, we've eaten his stuff, too. We're sort of omnivorous when it comes to chocolate.
Right.
Cho.
So in New York, there's a bunch of interesting ones. There's Fine and Raw. There's Raka, who does more like unroasted chocolate. In the Midwest, you've got Askenosi and Patrick.
Oh, he's the one with the Chocolate University. He does good, which is one of the other things I wanted to have you talk about, is a lot of philanthropy being done in education and helping fair trade and stuff. It seems to be another mission of the current crop of chocolate makers.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why we've started to see some success is because people tell us they are interested in knowing, you know, who's making their food and where it came from, and is it, not only is it safe, but can they trust it? You know, are there good labor practices? And,
yes.
You know, we do something interesting in our bars, which is we actually write on the back of the bar who sourced the beans. And usually it's Greg, who's our main chocolate sourcer, and he's always going down in the country, he's meeting with farmers. And so if people are interested in knowing more about the farms, they can literally come to our factory in San Francisco and ask to talk to Greg and learn about the farm firsthand. And we also publish a sourcing report that details every farm we work with, how much we paid for the beans, you know, who we worked with, who from the company visited the farm, what was the whole supply chain that got the beans to us. And so I think customers are getting more and more savvy and want to know that what they are paying for is A, worth the money and it's not fake, but B, is really trustworthy. We found that the more information we put out about the farms and who we work with, the better it is for everyone.
Now, does Greg go out? Does he travel to Africa regularly to sniff out the good chocolate?
Yeah, Greg is always on the road. I'd say not as much Africa, but more Central and South America, and then we send other team members as well. But also we get a ton of samples sent to us. It's funny. I think when we first started, we would just kind of randomly travel to a country and try to find the good beans. And what we found out is that didn't really work for us because we'd bring the beans back and they weren't necessarily very good. And what we do now is people send us samples from all over, and every one of those samples we turn into a small batch of chocolate And every once in a while, we find something really amazing, and we say, okay, I want to find out more about this farm. How do we, you know, where did this come from? Let's figure this out. And so it's a bit more efficient to kind of taste everything first and then sort of try to explore if we can work with that farm to and it meets our standards as well.
That's a good system.
It's a little bit, a little bit like the farm-to-table chef who will have arrangements with people who grow things, and they'll just come and deposit them on his back doorstep. It was one of our favorites. You remember when Zafferano, they said the vegetables for the week. They didn't know what they were until they came into the restaurant on Monday morning.
Yeah.
When there would be a big box of green stuff outside the back door.
So they
wouldn't know what they were going to have. And another one who said pretty much exactly what you said. People sort of know us. No, because our name is well known, and that, increasingly, I'm guessing, fortunately, it's happening with you as well. So people in the chocolate world have now heard of you, so they know that you're someone they can trust.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, definitely. And it is funny. We've had people show up at our chocolate factory. So our chocolate factory in San Francisco also is like a little cafe, so people can come in. And we had somebody pull up in a truck with a bag of beans, and we're like, this is crazy. Like, this is, you know, that's kind of a weird way to get beans. They just kind of dropped them off. But then, you know, we tried them, and it ended up being some of the beans we really loved. So, you know, you never know kind of what you're going to get, but you have to sort of try everything and sort of have an open mind, because sometimes what's really good is a little bit unexpected or not what everyone else does.
How do you guarantee uniformity or what am I trying to say? You know what I mean?
Consistency
is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that is a great question. So we generally end up working more with centralized fermenteries, where what they'll do is you'll have all these smallholder farms where, you know, people have just a little plot or two. And if we bought beans directly from every single plot, they would be very inconsistent and hard to make into a good bar of chocolate. And instead, what we'll do is often work with a sort of community organization that will ferment the beans centrally so that the beans that we get in sort of a shipment or a container load are very consistent. And that's good for us because if we do our taste test and figure out how we want to process these beans and what flavors we're looking for, then we can sort of continue to use those beans without them sort of being random or changing all the time. Mm-hmm. The thing I would say, though, that is different about us compared to, say, larger companies is consistency is not one of our stated goals, and especially from harvest to harvest. So, you know, we'll use beans from Madagascar, and we use it from Bertil Atkinson's farm, and we love these beans, and every year we get them, and every year they're fruity, but every year the fruit flavor is different. Some years it was like berries, some years it was cherries or citrus or even raisins. And so rather than to work really hard to kind of roast the beans more heavily or, say, add vanilla to make them taste more similar, what we do is we just put on the bar, this is this year's harvest, it's sort of like the 2015 vintage, let's say, and these are the notes that we taste, and we really like them, but it might not be what you had last year, but that's okay. It's more like a bottle of wine where every year the conditions are going to change, and rather than work hard to make everything be the lowest common denominator, instead we'll try to celebrate what's interesting about that particular harvest.
Well, you must have really good palates and staff there, huh?
You know, we work at it a lot. We taste a lot of different chocolate. We try a lot of different ingredients, but the thing that we have found, and this sort of comes out of our Silicon Valley leanings, is that we always do blind taste tests, and we always do comparative taste tests. So what we'll do is, it's very hard, I find, just to take, a little bit of chocolate and pull out the notes sort of right away. But if you're tasting three or four chocolates back-to-back, and maybe all we did was vary, you know, the roast time by a minute or two, if you're tasting them blind and back-to-back, it is very easy to pick out the differences, and then you can start to get better and better at it. So we always use that sort of methodology to get the good flavor out of the beans.
Now, let's do the important thing for those of you, our listeners around the world, but certainly around the United States, who are chocoholics. How do they get some dandelion?
How do they get some dandelion? The best way to get some dandelion is obviously to come to San Francisco. Because then not only will you get to try the chocolate, but you get to see the whole factory in action.
Do you do tours?
The factory is totally open to the public, and you can just, you know, stand there behind the glass and watch everything that's happening.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We have, you know, we sort of put this cafe in the front, and so we've had people come in just because they like hot chocolate or they want to eat a brownie, but then they stick around and they watch the production process. They start asking questions. And then before we know it, they've gone on a tour, or they take a class with us, or we actually run trips to Belize and the Dominican Republic and other places. And so we've had people who walk in just because they want, you know, to get their quick fix, and then turn into evangelists for us because they get to see sort of all the chocolate in action. So yeah, I would say best bet is come visit us in San Francisco, but we also have an online store where you can buy our bars and have them shipped. And then we are also available in some stores throughout the country and a few around the world, although in the past we've been very limited in the amount of chocolate we can make, and so we've always been the most stocked kind of in our own stores. But hopefully if you check our website, you can find some stores near you that might have our chocolate.
And let me give you a plug, because I did this before we came on the air. Your website has all kinds of fascinating stories, like what happened with the macaroons. And by the way, we were at this dinner and somebody made an apple out of chocolate and sprayed it green just so that it looked really like an apple, and wasn't that fun. So it's a great connection if you're at all interested in the world of confectionery and especially chocolate. This is the kind of thing that will give you a great start to the day just to read another of these charming stories.
Well, Todd, it's really great to talk to you, and I was glad to find you.
Yeah, it's been great to talk to you as well. And yeah, as you were saying, from day one, we've had sort of this blog with we just kind of write whatever is going on in the company. And so you can actually go back, you know, years now to when we were just in the garage and, you know, trying this piece of duct tape with this fan and, you know, seeing if we could even get the shell to come off the beans. And so now, you know, obviously the company has changed a lot, but we've all just posted it all out there. So a lot of cool, interesting stories from throughout the years you should check out on the website.
Right. And the website is?
It's dandelionchocolate.com.
And then singular chocolate.
Down, yeah, so no S, just dandelionchocolate.com. Right. And then especially if you scroll down, you'll start to see the blog, and then you can just, you know, keep flipping back and reading more stories.
It's a pleasure, and keep up the good work, Todd.
Awesome. Thanks so much. It was so good to talk to you guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest is hilarious. She's hilarious, but she's also serious. The book is called The Virtuous Tart, Sinful but Saintly Recipes for Sweets, Treats, and Snacks. And this is what happens when a medical condition led her to research the causes of her condition, an autoimmune disorder that the doctors didn't know what to say about it. But she figured it out, and her recipes are, as I said, virtuous. And she is amazingly funny. Well, you know, Susan Jane White. I mean, I've had friends with three names, and they generally like to have the first name inclusive with the, like, I had one Elizabeth Ann, and who were some of the other ones. So I'm calling this wonderful woman Susan Jane.
Thank you.
And her book
is nice to have you. Yeah,
her book is funny. I mean, it's hilarious. You have such a great sense of humor, and it's called.
Oh, thank you, Anne.
Yeah, it's called The Virtuous Tart. So that should give you some idea how about this certain irreverence throughout the book, and it's subtitled "Sinful but Saintly Recipes for Sweets, Treats, and Snacks." And you know, I'd like your little your chapter titles too.
Can you
remember some of those?
I think some of them are rather rude. Maybe I should spare your listeners.
Yeah, no, I like the rude ones. Well, I mean, you've got a virgin drink. So that gives you an idea. But maybe...
English chapter as well. And
tell me, you had some health issues, which is why you decided to write this book, right?
That's right. Yeah, I did. I had health issues. And you know what? Even before I had any health complications, I was young at the time, and I thought I was invincible. So I was 25. I was living the dream. I was an Oxford University scholar, research scholar. So I'd worked all my life since I was a tiny girl to get into Oxford. And here I was, at the pinnacle of my career. I was what seemed visually, I looked healthy, because I didn't have a huge amount of weight on me. I was slim, but we often forget that slim people can be very unhealthy inside.
Right.
And very sick, and it's not visible. So I persisted in my studies while eating junk food, just living off junk food. And by junk food, I mean anything that had an expiry date of probably a good decade later, or something that I could grab and go, because I found it taxing to my way of life at the time in the library constantly, that if I had to queue up in a supermarket or a store and cook my own meal, I was taking a lot of time away. And I thought, yeah, the smartest thing to do was to outsource this part of my life and live off convenience foods. And I used to cackle, the irony when I think back, I used to cackle at the queues, cycling past the queues and stores and thinking, God, what are these people doing? It's peak hour, they're all queuing up for their vegetables. And I've since learned that actually smart people make time to cook. Because you can't outsource your health. You just can't. And in the short term, you may feel fine, but in the long term, it's going to bite you back. And that's what it did. It disrupted my studies. I started suffering from insomnia. I was constantly sick. I didn't have time to be sick, so I was going to the doctor and getting antibiotics.
Oh, God,
and then rode forward several months. Yeah, and I imagine a huge number of your listeners have been in certain circumstances like this. They have, especially busy moms, you don't have time to be sick. So you're constantly on pills and going to the doctor. And suddenly your body just says, no, that's it, and breaks down. And I ended up in hospital quite a bit.
Oh, dear.
And nobody could figure out, nobody could figure out what was wrong as I horsed into another burger and drank a soda. In one sense, here I was at Oxford University. You know, I was a smart kid. In another one, I was pretty dumb, not looking at my diet and what I was putting into my body, because that was the fuel that was supposed to sustain me. And eventually, it took a really savvy, empathetic GP who said, "Look, why don't we look at your diet and peel back all the complicated things and start from the beginning." With very simple protein and greens. So I lived off fish and meat and just green veggies for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then slowly built my body back again. And during that period, it felt like somebody was sucking the illness out of my body. So I had this profound connection between what I put in my body and how I felt. And it was so profound that I just decided I want to try and share my experience and make sure that no one goes through the pain and suffering I did again. And I wanted to research this so nobody else had to. And so 10 years on, even longer, I think about 14 years on, that's exactly what I'm doing. I still write about it. I'm from Ireland. I'm sure your listeners have guessed the accent by now.
Not only that, but the storytelling ability. That's so Irish.
Is that right? never taking a breath, maybe. I write for our biggest Irish national newspaper. And 10 years ago when I started writing for them about this journey, they all thought I was nuts, but suddenly it's become mainstream. We're a little behind America when it comes to these things. So for Ireland, it was very progressive, and now it's very much so an accepted way of eating. People are far more conscious than now with junk food and opening up their diet to incorporate a lot more ingredients we'd never have known what to do with, or walking into a store and having a little bit more confidence and reading about all the different beans that are in front of you, or the flour. So we don't rely on white flour. We also have brown rice flour, garbanzo flour. We have millet flour. There's such a huge range and portfolio of ingredients now at our fingertips that this journey that I've been on, had I never fallen ill, I wouldn't have discovered any of these incredible ingredients. And they're much nicer than the foods that I was living off before. So it's been a bittersweet journey, and I know that your listeners can relate to that.
Although you studied at Oxford, you're really from Dublin, and that's where you're talking to us from now.
That's right. That's where I'm talking to you from now. Yeah, I thought I'd stunned you into silence there.
No, and stunned me into silence.
So back to this book. Your recipes are supporting, I'm going to put it that way, gluten-free, dairy-free, and no refined sugar. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Although, funny, I don't see myself in that category. I think mainly for booksellers, it's on the front cover to alert them that it's not a regular cookbook, shall we say. But instead of excluding things from your diet, I'm all for adding things into your diet. So at no point in the book do I ever suggest anybody give up dairy or gluten. In fact, I have a chapter, a small chapter on gluten, warning people that, you know, kind of lightheartedly saying, wow, if Ebola doesn't get a gluten, well, no, just kidding. Because that's just the frenzy that has been whipped up, I think, in the media in the last few years. Lots of people are going on a gluten-free diet. And if it's working for you, that's wonderful. But I don't want people thinking gluten is a poison. It's not.
Right.
Only if you have celiac disease or you have a sensitivity. And you'll know that yourself. Now, there's no harm in following the fads. It can be fun. And some people really enjoy doing that. And that's no problem. But I wanted to make it very clear that I don't think people should ever give up food groups because that's penitential. And I'm all about taking the hell out of healthy.
Yeah.
So I'd much rather see them adding things in. And this book, The Virtuous Cart, helps people add in flours that maybe they have in their kitchen right now and don't know what to do with them. And even things like almond meal. I think you called it almond flour in the States, is that right?
Yes.
Or ground almonds. But I see this as, you know, saint of eternal youth. There's so many beautiful oxidants, a fleet of minerals, and even calcium, and vitamin E especially. Great anti-aging.
Yeah, you like vitamin E.
That's in there.
Yeah.
I love vitamin E.
Yeah.
So that excites me. And, you know, white flour never boasts the same. So it's an introduction. The Virtuous Cart is an introduction to other flours that you may never have heard of or you might have in your kitchen, and other sugars, other forms of sugars like...
Yeah, you have extensive descriptions of variants of flour, also of sugar, and also of milk. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, who gave you the ideas for these hilarious photos?
Oh!
I mean, how about you with the chocolate mustache? It's pretty funny.
Thank you. That's just me. That's just me playing around.
So you're wacky.
Luckily,
you're a little wacky here.
Thank you. Well, I always thought that cookbooks were quite almost prosaic. The ones that were on offer to me in the last decade, they were quite predictable, and I think largely boring for me. I needed inspiration when I couldn't find it, and I decided I wanted to provide that kind of book where. A book should be like your brother or your sister in the kitchen, making you laugh, goofing around, and being a real companion, rather than having just steps on what to do and being very serious and po-faced. So that's what I set out to achieve. I'm really lucky because, I mean, this is a small island. The photographer is a friend of mine. And the food stylist who helped me out is also a friend of mine. So it's amazing that they were chosen to be, you know, here. And we didn't go to a set. It was all photographed in my home. And it's very extra heavy as well, the book. So I'm lucky that my publishers had encouraged that. So we just had loads of fun for a week.
Yeah, and you're lucky also to have such absolutely gorgeous photogenic children.
Oh, thank
you. Tell us who they are.
Oh, but they're 5 and 6 now. They're my little vandals, I call them, because I most of the time, actually, I don't feel like a mother at all. I feel like an umpire. It's really about damage control, and 2 can feel like 20, not only just on a day-to-day basis, but also cooking for them. So they are the best restaurant critics you could ever have, because they tell us.
They won't eat it. It's not tasty.
They won't
eat it.
They sound.
And I really enjoy. Say that again?
They sound a little bit like my cousins Michael and Edward, who I hope are not listening to the program, because my biggest worry growing up was that they might kill each other.
Well, I can relate to that.
I thought maybe
they don't
you could.
Kill each other, I'll kill them some days.
Can I suggest, by the way, that we should up front say that these are not your ordinary recipes. There's a flair about these and some exotic ingredients. I'm looking at, I thought these were very clever, the acai and beetroot macaroons.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about those.
Yeah, so there are, I love falling for the latest superfood. I can't help but figure out where to find it, where to buy it, and how to get it into my diet. So there will be some recipes with hard-to-find ingredients like acai. There's this crazy berry from the Amazon that has found its way to Ireland. So, of course, it can't be fresh all the way over here in Ireland, so they freeze dry it, and that makes it easy to add into recipes. But it's got an insane amount of antioxidants into it, so I like to sneak it into my children's little snacks. And what I've done with those little macaroons is they can be vegan because there's no eggs or there's no animal produce in it if you take out the honey and replace it with, say, brown rice syrup. But again, brown rice syrup isn't something that you're going to get in your local corner store. You'll need to go to a Whole Foods store or a Trader Joe's to get that. But the idea in a lot of these recipes is to introduce you to these crazy foods. And then some would be far more basic, encouraging others who don't have a lot of experience in the kitchen to make the more basic ones. So the one you chose there, the acai macaroons, it's just a mixture of we call it desiccated coconut. It's a finely chopped coconut with a bit of honey, coconut flour, which soaks up any moisture, and then the acai, which is this bright purple color. And then we mix it all together and use an ice cream scoop or a small tablespoon scoop and make them into tiny macaroons, put them in the freezer, and you can eat them straight from frozen. And they're the kind of things my boys canter home from school and reach straight into the freezer for a snack. And it's wonderful because they think they're dirty treats. They think that it's trash. So they're sneaking them behind my back, and I just let them do that with their play dates.
When I talk about this creative in photos, I mean, I don't know how you got to this one. Here, it's your recipe for activated nuts, and it's a giant mason jar, canning jar, whatever it's the brand is, with nuts and a bicycle in front of us.
I know.
What was that about?
Yeah, we're trying to think, instead of just having plain photographs, we wanted to personalize as many photographs as possible. So where we didn't feature in it, or parts of our bodies didn't feature in it, we try to communicate more than just the food. So activated nuts it's a trend, so I wanted to put a recipe into them. It's when you soak nuts and then you, bake them at a very low temperature or dehydrate them. I know dehydrators are popular in California, for example. Uh-huh. In Ireland, they're not at all, so we bake things at a low temperature instead. And what activates, it destroys certain enzyme inhibitors and activates the nut. In other words, they believe it awakens their sort of optimum nutrition. Now, there's mixed theories on that, and I say as much in the recipe, but God, they taste so good. So I'm very happy to do it that way when I can. But activated nuts, it's such a funny word. It sounds like something you find in the front row of a Justin Bieber concert, you know? So we try to communicate a little bit more than just a boring old nut. And so that's why we have it sitting on a little miniature bicycle in front of a big mason jar of nuts, as if it's...
you have these different flowers. I mean, what really is your favorite flour to bake with?
My favorite flour to bake with. Well, as I mentioned, the almond meal. I really love the effects of having almonds in my diet. I can feel the difference in my skin. I mean, there's definitely side effects, including more whole grain flours like brown rice flour makes a magnificent cupcake. And garbanzo flour. And the way I look at it, about the side effects, the so-called side effects, I talk about it. Well, the first one is your skin and your hair and your nails. You'll see the difference when you make the switch from using boring white flour to all these whole grain flours with way more antioxidants and minerals than your average white flour. And then the second is that, well, healthy eating, you don't have to avoid gluten to be healthy. You know, don't worry about having gluten. Rye flour is also a brilliant flour. It's got gluten in it. It doesn't bother me. It's still indecently healthy. It's had such a bad reputation for gluten that I think my husband thinks it's something that wild teenagers sniff. I had to tell him it's not.
Wow.
And then the third thing is that healthy eating should never sacrifice your taste buds. And whole grain flours don't. They're all very complex and unique in how they taste. They have a different flavor profile, and I see white flour as a blank canvas, whereas whole grain flours all import their own unique flavor, and that's what makes me so excited about getting to know them in my kitchen.
We had some discussion, and my husband being English, I asked him first. You talk about tiffin. What is a tiffin?
Oh, yeah, tiffin is a funny word. I believe, now maybe your listeners can correct me on this, I believe tiffin is kind of like a snack. It's an Indian little snack box that they have, or a little sort of little lunch. And in here in Ireland, it's a word to describe a very particular recipe, probably unrelated at all.
Because Peter said it was like tea time, a meal.
Yeah.
But then you referred to a slice of tiffin, so I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, I think it's one of these strange things that have morphed into in Ireland and probably been exported to the UK, but maybe not beyond. So tiffin is like a bar. They sell them here, like trashy confectionery bars, and it's just hydrogenated fat, biscuits, marshmallows, raisins, all thrown into this kind of chocolatey chunk. The Irish go crazy for it, so there's a recipe for tiffin in there, but a much healthier one and a much better one as well. I had the both fortunate and unfortunate experience to marry a restaurant critic here in Ireland. So
you're married to a restaurant critic?
Yeah, retired now. Although he says retired, but I can tell you he's still criticizing.
Yeah, no, once a restaurant critic. I mean, I did that for 14 years, I know.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's hard to break the habit.
It is. So you know I'm, yeah.
I guess I'm just giving a hint that there may be some word, what would I say, enlightenment through different words that you're not used to thinking about in cookbooks. And also, I imagine the measurements. Could you just explain the measurements?
The measurements, yeah. I have, the book has been translated into cups for the American market. So it's all in cups. And the liquid measurements are in fluid ounces. And it's not very different to what I use at home, even though I'm Irish and Irish like to use grams and ounces. I love the American cup, or the European cup as well, which is slightly different to the American, but only by such a small, almost negligent amount. So my cup, I've been using is the European cup, which is approximately 237 mils. And then the American cup is 250 mils, or vice versa. So there's very little difference. And luckily that doesn't impact on any of the recipes in the book.
Great.
Because we recipe tested everything again, and it translates to half a tablespoon.
Uh-huh.
In recipes. Now, I'd say with Michelin star chefs, half a tablespoon is a huge amount, but I'm a home cook, so all my recipes are very forgiving, and they're designed to be forgiving because, you know, mom of crazy two children and working, I can't be responsible for if I throw a few extra tablespoons of flour or sweetener in.
Yeah.
I still have to make sure it works out. So that's something that's very different with my cookbook.
Listeners, this is a stimulating book as well as a healthier kind of recipes. Susan Jane White, The Virtuous Tart. I mean, I think you think of yourself as a virtuous tart, right?
Well, certainly a tart.
I wish you really good luck with your book, and congratulations on making a recipe book, a cookery book that is also humorous and lighthearted. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne and Peter.
Well, there you have it. A really sweet program. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope that you'll pursue the interesting angles on life provided by Dana Cree, and who's the chocolate man, the dandelion chocolate man, who's a really remarkable fellow, and then a touch of the Irish just to finish off your day.
Todd Masonis you're looking for, and you want to know who the virtuous tart is?
Sure, sure. You caught me by surprise there.
Yeah, you do that to me.
You're shuffling
Susan
papers.
Susan Jane White.
And Susan Jane White with the Irish brogue comes from Dublin. And you'd never have guessed. And you'll never guess where we're going to be, same time, same place next week. But we hope you'll be in the same place, wherever that is. And so that kind of gives you a clue.
Bye-bye.